This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Folks, May is World Cancer Research Month, and here to talk to us about that and so much more about what the LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center is doing is Dr. Lucio Mille, and he is the director of the LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center. Excuse me. Doc, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. How are you? Great to be with you.
Doing great, Doc. Thank you so much for joining us. If you would, let's just start out for the benefit of the listening audience, the importance of May and the world being World Cancer Research Month.
Yeah, I'll just start with a few numbers. Over the past 30 years or so, since 1991, cancer mortality has decreased by 33 to 34%, meaning it's down by a third. However, the number of new cancers has not decreased. For some cancers, it has. For some, it's actually going up, especially in younger people. So if we've got similar numbers of new cancers and fewer deaths, what it means is that we have learned how to diagnose earlier and treat better the cancers that we do see. And that is all the result of cancer research. None of this would have happened without research into new prevention strategies, but also new diagnostic techniques and new treatments. So I cannot overemphasize the importance of research to improving the treatment of cancer and the way society deals with cancer as a whole.
Doc, I read an article, it's probably several years ago, talking about the frailty of bringing the results of all cancer research together in one database. That folks thought that was something that absolutely needed to be accomplished. Do you know if we're any closer to that goal?
There are similar databases, but you got to be careful when putting all kinds of disparate data together into one big bucket. If these data are not comparable to each other, you end up creating more confusion than light. One of the initiatives that LSU is actually part of is the so-called GENIE initiative. Mm-hmm. What it is, it's a consortium of cancer centers that is sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of, for Cancer Research, AACR, and it collects de-identified, meaning without names or any other elements that can identify who the patients are, clinical and molecular data from cancers. There are 200 plus thousand cancer cases in this database, and the data comes from the United States, from Europe, from Japan, from Korea. And these are publicly available to investigators to look at the relationship between what genes are on or off in a cancer and how the cancer responds to certain treatments. So, there are significant efforts in that direction, but big databases only work if the quality of the data that goes in them is equally good. Otherwise, they're not necessarily the solution.
And I guess there's a role and a growing role for artificial intelligence, right? And not only dealing with all the breadth and depth of the data, but the manner in which you're conducting some of the cancer experiments in the lab today utilizing AI.
That is a huge, huge factor. AI isn't really new, but it has developed to the point that we can actually use it for all sorts of things. For example, you use AI today to screen for new drugs. Instead of just doing a lot of trial and error in the laboratory, screening millions of chemicals against a simple target to see which ones might be a hit, many of these things can now be done entirely via computer through AI algorithms. And in fact, investigators at our cancer center are involved in doing that sort of work right now. Then you can use AI to look at images from pathologist slides, digital pathology it's called. So if you have thousands and thousands and thousands of images from different cancers, and you also know how these cancers responded to treatment and what genes are up or down in those cancers, you can train an AI algorithm to predict what a cancer is going to respond to in terms of treatment simply by looking at it. This is not something that a human brain can do. Of course, again, you need really high-quality data to be able to train this algorithm, and you do need human oversight to make sure that what the algorithm predicted is in fact what happened. But these are things that were science fiction even a few years ago.
And I guess AI is able to do it, obviously, faster, more efficiently, with a higher efficacy rate than the human eye and human comprehension, right?
Well, yes. I mean, the point is not AI is not magic. It's simply a very, very, very large amount of brute force. It can hold in its memory more than a human brain ever will. And so it can compare in the blink of an eye one image to millions of other images. It doesn't forget anything. It doesn't get things wrong. As long as you put the right information in it in the first place, it can do things that humans are just not able to do.
So for decades now, in Louisiana, we have had a disproportionate share per capita of cancer cases. Is that still the case?
Yes. Our cancer mortality is approximately 40% higher than the national average. And our incidence is higher for some cancers, but not others. Prostate and lung come to mind. Our breast cancer mortality is among the worst in the country. And there are several factors that go into that. One of them is stage of diagnosis. We need to do a better job of diagnosing cancers early on. And for cancers for which there are screening procedures, we need to screen. These are breast cancer, cancer of the uterine cervix, cancer of the colon. We need to expand screening so that cancers can be diagnosed at an earlier stage. The cure for cancer, if you will, a single cure is not realistic, but an early diagnosis is closer to a cure than a late diagnosis. It's possible today to cure many cancers as long as you catch them early. Then we've got certain risk factors for cancer that are particularly prevalent in Louisiana. One of them is obesity, where unfortunately ground zero for the obesity and diabetes epidemic. And obesity is a major risk factor for 13 different types of cancer, from colorectal to endometrial cancer to certain types of breast cancer, not all types. And so that puts our population at higher risk. Tobacco use is decreasing, and that's wonderful news because cancers associated with tobacco are still among the most lethal, like lung cancer. And then we've got the potential for environmental pollutants. There's a stretch of Louisiana between New Orleans and Baton Rouge where certain parts of it, not the entire stretch, but certain parts of it have really high cancer incidence, and we don't really understand why that is. And we're actually trying to launch an investigation of this. So, yeah, Louisiana is particularly in need when it comes to cancer research, cancer prevention, cancer diagnosis, and cancer treatment.
So there's no doubt that the necessity of our cancer care, our cancer research needs to be alive and well, fully funded. The federal government at the present time is rethinking a lot of what they're doing. Is there something there that really concerns you?
Well, the reality is that you get what you pay for. You don't make discoveries and you don't develop better treatments if somebody doesn't support it financially. I am hopeful that our nation will remain one of the leaders in cancer research in the world. We have been the leader for a long time, but that's not going to happen without appropriate federal funding. There is no real substitute for that. Of course, industry is an important partner, but that happens when products are already at the stage of development. Developing these products comes from discoveries that are made in academic institutions, generally with federal funding. The way I explain it is researchers funded by the NIH are people who mine the unknown for precious stones, for diamonds. And then industry comes and turns them into jewelry that can be sold. So, there is no substitute for federal funding, and I am hopeful that particularly in states like ours that suffer disproportionately from cancer, we're not going to see the drastic cuts that are being discussed, because they would be devastating.
And in your case, and the Cancer Center, you guys have already proven yourself over and over and over again, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, we have maintained active cancer research, and by that I mean not just laboratory research, I also mean clinical research, population research, community engagement for several years. But we do need to achieve a critical mass, if you will, in order to receive NCI designation, because that's then going to build onto itself and put us on the map as one of the top centers in the country. I cannot exaggerate the importance of NCI designation as something that's completely transformative. One example that I often use is that of the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, that started in 1981. Not much happened until 1995 when the state of Florida decided to make a significant investment in that cancer center. 6 years later, they achieved NCI designation, and they are now a comprehensive cancer center that brings over $2 billion to the local economy of the Tampa area per year and sees patients from all over the world going there for treatment. This is what you can get with an NCI designated cancer center in your state.
Doc, how many are there? And NCI stands for National Cancer Institute, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. There are 73 in the whole country, plus a few more to a total of 92 that are called emergent cancer centers, and that's the category that we fall in, meaning we are preparing to apply for National Cancer Institute designation within the next few years. That's a program that started in the 1970s with the National Cancer Act that was signed by President Nixon, and it has revolutionized cancer treatment and research in this country.
And there is not one in the state of Louisiana, right?
There is not one in the state of Louisiana or in the state of Mississippi or in the state of Arkansas. The two closest NCI-designated cancer centers to us right now are the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which was designated in 1974, again, with strong support from their state, and the cancer centers in Houston, Texas. So 6 hours away in one direction or 7 hours away in the other. It's important to have our patients be able to be treated at a designated cancer center where they are, rather than having to go out of state for treatment.
You know, we establish these affiliations. They're nice, I guess, but it's not like having control of everything that you need right here, right?
It's not the same thing. It's certainly nice, and you know, we do collaborate with many other cancer centers on a routine basis. Designated cancer centers, but that doesn't mean it's not the same thing as having one right here, because the process of designation really scrutinizes every aspect of what you do. Your community engagement, your training program, your clinical service line, your clinical trials, everything, not just the laboratory research. You have to have enough research to qualify, but everything is scrutinized in a process that's called a site visit, whereby experts from all over the country just come here and basically test us and look at everything that we've been doing. And if we pass all these tests, we get designated. The designation itself is a relatively small financial grant from the National Cancer Institute, but it opens the door to opportunities that are not open to centers that are not designated, including additional research grants and additional trials and things that you're just not in the club until you are in the club.
So what is your confidence level? We're in the application process now that will achieve this designation. I know there's a lot that has been done here in the city with medical education and research and alike relative to cancer research. Where are we on a scale of 1 to 10? Where do you think we are?
We're about 4. What that means is that we've got all the pieces in place and we've got enough grant money to qualify, especially if the NIH budget doesn't get slashed. Then we need to hire more. We're hiring actively. In the last few months, ever since I took on this job, we hired two clinicians and two basic scientists. We need to keep hiring at the rate of 5 to 10 people per year for the next 4 to 5 years to have the kind of critical mass that would make me comfortable with an application. And this is not unique to Louisiana. Another cancer center that I have a lot of experience with because I used to work there is the University of Illinois at Chicago. Again, that's a state university like us. They just submitted their application and they got an excellent score that hopefully will bring them to be funded. They started 25 years ago.
Wow.
So we're now in the final stretch of a process that started here as well after Katrina.
Yeah, obviously it's a lengthy process and you have to prove yourself over and over and over again. If there's anything that we can do to bring more attention to this, Dr. Lucio Mele, Director, LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center, please let us know because this is critical to healthcare in our region for sure. And we thank you for your leadership on this front.
you are most welcome, and I'll be always willing and able to answer any questions from our community.
Thank you, sir. Best of luck to you. We will be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
With us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Neil. Happy to be here.
Ron, I first wanted to talk about Congress real quick first, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Your thoughts about where we stand with the one great bill.
Well, you know, the one great bill, or as some people have called it, the one beautiful bill.
Beautiful bill. Like, I'm sorry. I mislabeled it.
I've lost my track of the adjectives here, but essentially what this is that it's a budget reconciliation matter that can be passed with a majority of the Senate, which means that it is passable by the Republicans in the Senate. Trump is loading up onto it, and as are Republicans in Congress, a lot of things that are germane to the bill. That they think they can get done. They want to push as much, you know, use this as a vehicle to carry as much legislation as they possibly can without needing a 60-vote majority in the Senate. So ultimately, they will likely pass, you know, a one big beautiful bill. Exactly what it has in it, we don't know. But even though there's some tough Republican potential opposition in the House based on certain different issues, I think they'll probably work a lot of that out and get a bill to the Senate. And I think they can probably pass it if they try not to overreach and go too far.
What would an overreach for you look like? I mean, I know you're probably familiar with some of the provisions in this bill. A lot of the tax relief seems to be getting some pushback as it, for some, that may be the dividing line where the overreach is.
Yeah, you know, anytime you're dealing with taxes, it's easy to overreach, and it's also easy to end up giving tax relief to certain constituencies that may not be so popular, and not giving them the constituencies that are popular. I mean, one of the things that Trump promised when he won was that he would eliminate taxes on tips, which was of course very popular among people in the hospitality and restaurant and bar industry, and use that to win the state of Nevada, for example. He's also promised to eliminate income taxes on Social Security income, which is frankly very popular among Social Security recipients. And a lot of Social Security recipients make the point that, you know, the money they're getting, at least in part, in Social Security monthly benefits, is their money. You know, it's money that they put in the system. And so they feel like they've already been taxed on that money. So getting the Social Security benefits without paying taxes is something that they would like to get. There's a lot of battling back and forth on the state and local tax exemptions. For some reason, they keep saying this benefits high tax states, although it actually benefits taxpayers in all the states, because it gives taxpayers more opportunity to deduct state and local taxes from their federal taxes. So all of these things are popular, but at the same time, you know, they reduce federal revenue. And when you reduce federal revenue at a time that you have a $1.8 trillion deficit, that's another problem, because Trump has also promised that he would get rid of the deficit and start cutting the national debt. And I can tell you that's not happening. So because no matter how much they cut, they're not going to get rid of a $1.9 trillion deficit. And that's what you have to do to start whittling the national debt down. And it's not going to happen. The Elon Musk cuts, for example, are supposedly going to produce about $163 billion in cuts. But at the same time, they're talking about increasing defense spending and spending in Homeland Security of about that same amount of money. So you know, if that in effect happens, then, you know, it won't have any effect basically on the federal deficit. The deficit will continue to stay about what it is.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interesting conversation. I brought this up earlier with Michael Heck about moving back to the old model relative to Medicaid financing. And I keep bringing this up, and I know people probably think I'm crazy because I do so. But in our state, when you have 32% of people on Medicaid, anytime you tweak this a little bit, I think the outcome's going to be relatively dire consequences, I think is a fair statement. And I'm kind of curious, you know, because they're saying they could stomach a $500 billion reduction in Medicaid over the next 10 years, which would be about a $50 billion reduction annually. But nobody's really talking about how that's going to be implemented and what programs it's going to appear in. But nonetheless, when you have one third of your population on Medicaid, something bad is going to happen. There's no doubt about it.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things I learned as a legislator was the danger of matching funds. You know, it's very easy to pass legislation where you say, well, the state will match money from the federal government, or local governments will match money from state government, and that's a partnership, and everybody works together, and you can get things done. But it also really confuses and complicates the whole revenue structure of government. And Medicaid is the primary example. I believe Medicaid in most states, if not all states, is the number one spending category right now. That wasn't the case some years back, but it is now, and it's going up. And of course, it's attracting and matching a lot of federal money, but it's still costing the states a lot of money. And as you pointed out, any way you change those formulas or you change the way matching system works in reality is going to have a big impact on states. And Louisiana, a poor state with a lot of Medicaid recipients, would be affected probably more than anybody. So these are big issues. And of course, you have to keep in mind that, you know, the top two majority members of the House are from Louisiana, Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise. So you know, from a Louisiana perspective, I would think they will be working to protect the state. But they've got some big fish to fry here. And
you know, it's interesting. You brought up the match because you're so right. States have gone about creating these exotic financing schemes. CMS has approved them over the years. Not just Louisiana, all states are doing
right.
it, which is diminishing the amount of money that the state is putting up. And Republicans are now having these conversations about trying to, when it first started, it was like a 50-50 split. And they're trying to get it back to maybe the state's putting up 30% or 40%. Well, the reality is, when you do the math in this state couldn't afford getting to 30%. I don't think they could hit that number. I don't know where they would find the money.
Yeah,
I don't think
I
it's
agree.
Available.
Right. I don't know how they could hit that number either, because at the same time, you know, the current trend is pretty strong, and that is less federal money for state and local governments. And when you look at money for state governments, you have to also look at money for local governments, because oftentimes when local governments have fiscal needs, they immediately run to state governments to get it. So you're going to have a big squeeze here in the state and local government financing that's coming along. And that's going to have a big impact on the future. And just what you said, you know, if the state had to pick up, you know, billions more to keep Medicaid going, that would be really rough. And on the state budget, and on the other side of the coin, is when you have a state with a high poor population, a high population that qualifies for Medicaid, and you take them off of that. That health insurance, it causes other problems. So yeah, Louisiana is in a potential fix, as are states all over the country.
Let's get to a break. When we come back, we'll pivot to the Louisiana legislature. Interesting bill put forward, Ron, by Representative Matthew Willard, while we're talking about finances, wanting to increase the homestead exemption to $125,000 and allowing the governing authority of each parish to decide whether or not they're willing to do that. We'll talk about the political ramifications and implications of same as well when we return with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Stay with us, folks. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We're going to pivot to the Louisiana legislature. There's a bill that's making its way through committees, the House Ways and Means Committee, advancing House Bill 271 by State Rep. Matthew Willard, that would call for an amendment to the Constitution to allow up to $125,000 homestead exemption. That would need the additional $50,000 would need to be approved by the governing authority. Your thoughts, Ron?
Well, I think that would, you know, it looks like a tax cut, but in some ways it's not, and I don't think it's a wise idea to do this. Essentially, we already have the first $75,000 of the fair market value of homes exempted from property taxes. Okay, and at the time that was passed in 1980. As I recall, the average price of a house in Louisiana was about $40,000. Now it's about $200,000. So the point is that, well, we're just raising it with inflation, but in effect that really isn't the full story. The full story is that when you're looking at property taxes, first of all, Louisiana is. State government is not in the property tax business. It's local governments that are. So you're affecting local government revenues. But even that, you're not cutting the revenues. You're moving the revenues around. For example, if you have a $200,000 house, It would lower the tax from $75,000 in value.
Coleman lost him.
$25,000 in value, but the value between $125,000 and $200,000, or if it's a $300,000 house, $300,000, the tax will go up because of the way the millages are adjusted. So it's really not much of a tax cut, and it would come at a time when state government and local government are trying to figure out how are they going to deal with lower revenues, as we were just talking about, and if you want to have tax cuts, you really should use them to build the economy. And what this would do is basically put more taxes on business, and it would make it more difficult to attract business to the state. And it also will create a whole lot of elections. You know, you're going to have a statewide election to approve it, and it probably would approve. And then you'd have to have 64 elections in all these parishes to approve it. And I would dare say most of the parishes would vote to approve it. And it would just create a whole lot of effort and unnecessary change that really wouldn't necessarily benefit anybody very much, and would continue and kind of build in some of the inequities of the current system. So I'm not sure that's such a good idea. It sounds like an idea that politicians who are looking to do something, you know, enrich themselves with, not enrich themselves, but enhance their popularity, would do before an election, but I'm not sure it makes a whole lot of sense. But it very well could pass.
Well, I think you're right, and I think he's running for one of the city council positions, if my memory serves me correct. But when you give this local option, you know, what we've heard from folks is that, you know, things are very difficult because we got so many different taxes and so many different jurisdictions. And here we are, we're going in the opposite direction, right? Right now it's a $75,000 across the board in the state of Louisiana. You don't get a local option.
Right.
It is what it is. And as you said, I mean, this would destroy local government and financing. I mean, they would have to get very creative. And the moment you start setting up these exotic tax schemes, you're in trouble. This is
right.
The most stable tax there is, right?
Sure. And outside of sales tax, it's about the only one, you know, for local governments. But, you know, the idea of the homestead exemption originally and through the 60s and 70s was, you know, when the average home price was in the $40,000 range, in effect, it said, we're going to take you off the rolls. You know, you're just not
right.
going to pay any tax if you have that. But this really isn't, you know, it's going to take a few more houses off the rolls, but it's going to increase taxes beyond that point. And since a lot of homes are now worth, like we pointed out, over $200,000, it's going to decrease part of their tax obligation, but it's going to increase part of their tax obligation. And it's one of these sort of political trick boxes that I'm not sure works very well.
Now, I can't imagine local government's really happy with this option because it'll cost a lot of people their position when you come out opposed to this thing.
Sure.
I think you're right. Sure. I think the constitutional issues, it'll pass overwhelmingly.
Sure. And a better solution, frankly, is for local governing authorities to look harder at millage roll up and roll back. So when the millages are adjusted, they demand the entities of local government to justify those increased revenues, which I think would be more effective than trying to do this.
No doubt. No doubt for sure. As always, we totally appreciate your time, your insight. Thank you so much, sir. Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Have a great week.
Thank you.
We'll be right back, folks. We'll check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way when we return. Scoot joins us. What do you have coming up, Scoot?
What do you think those Cardinals are really doing? I mean, you know, with the stuff that they wear, they could really fall asleep and nobody would even know. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that. Also, we have another update on that woman who's raising all that money for using the N-word. Yeah, more information out. We'll talk about that, too.
All righty. Stay tuned, folks. Scoot's headed your way with a great lineup. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Stay safe out there while driving around. We'll see you again in the morning.